the errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll look back at AFGE's recent District 12 training conference with the California Labor Federation's Executive Secretary Treasurer, Art Pulaski, and AFGE Social Security Administration Council 220 Health and Safety Representative, Howard Eggerman.
We've been joined by Art Pulaski, the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the California Labor Federation. Art, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you.
Very good to be with you, too. In fact, the California Labor Federation has a very strong and unique relationship with the American Federation of Government Employees, helping us, obviously, to secure the AFGE-TSA campaign win not too long ago, bringing on transportation security officers and helping them to ensure better workplace protections. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, you know, Jason, we have in California about 2.1 or 2.4 million union members in the state, probably 20% of the unionized workforce in America. And I have to say that we have long acknowledged and admired the AFGE membership from our vantage point. I mean, it's really an amazingly diverse workforce, from Social Security to the Border Patrols to the Environmental, to Department of Labor. It's really remarkable, Veterans Administration, a really remarkable set of skills that you represent and people that you represent. So we have a long relationship of admiration for the work that you do. And most recently, you know, I fly a lot, and so I get to see the TSOs, the security at the airports pretty frequently, and have long thought that they needed to have a union themselves because, you know, I'm not sure they get the best working conditions and hours of work and the best wages. And so we were really happy when the opportunity came around for the TSOs to decide to organize and that AFGE was there to help them do that. And in fact, it was really remarkable because we had union members from across sectors really come together to say, how can we help these TSOs get a better voice at work? And so we really had a lot of volunteers from lots of walks of life and many unions go to the airport and have little rallies and give support and offer to help talk to more TSOs. So I really think that it's a good example of the way unions work together here in California. The acknowledgement of the great work that AFGE does, the acknowledgement of the great work the TSOs do, and people coming together in a unified way, in a unified force to really help out. And we were so proud of the vote of the TSOs in California because it showed strong support for the union, strong need to have a voice at work, and strong solidarity among such a diverse workforce in California in support of those folks.
Talk about the importance of that, that people may not realize that having that collective voice at work is something that really can improve things like morale and whatnot.
Well, we find, particularly in big business and particularly in government, that workers can become anonymous and can't speak up on their own behalf in such large workforces. And the only way that people can have a voice at work is if we have a strong union to help people have that voice at work. I mean, it happens both at the workplace, but it also happens, we're finding, really, if you look at it in a broader sense, in terms of the catastrophe of the economic collapse caused by Wall Street. Wall Street recognizes that the only way that they're going to make more and more money, seeing the concentration of wealth that we have in America now, is that if they stop the voice of unions, of union members, to do something about this concentration of wealth. And really, as you look at it, the best voice in all of America to say, wait a minute, the rich are getting too rich, Wall Street's making too much money off of us, is union. And so how do unions protect the interest of the worker at the work site, our members, but also how do unions stand in support of the struggles of every working family, whether they're union members or not? And we really see that as a mission for the labor movement, if you will, to really fight on behalf of all those people, all those families. And so, I mean, in California, for example, we have 25% almost of our mortgages are underwater in California. We have 2 million families now in foreclosure with another million coming. No, more than that, another 10 million coming, we expect. And what we see is Wall Street and the conservative right, if you would, are blaming workers. They're blaming families for the economic collapse. They're blaming government employees and all union members for the economic collapse, when really it was the unregulated Wall Street that got away with murder, if you will. And so it's unions that are saying, wait a minute, how do we stop and change that? How do we protect the mortgages? How do we protect Social Security? How do we protect pensions? How do we protect health care? And again, the value to that is important, not just to our members, but to every struggling working family of the middle class in all of America.
You bring up a great point, and obviously with the Occupy rallies going on around the country, even right here in Oakland, tensions are high. What's the California Labor Federation doing to protect people from some of the things that you mentioned before?
You know, there are so many issues that we face, and from the federal issues to the state issues to the local issues. For example, we have local governments that are attempting to do away with local pension funds for local government workers. We have a crisis. I'm going to be meeting with the governor later this afternoon in Sacramento over pension reform efforts that are led by some in Sacramento. And so, for example, it's the pensions that affect workers, both local, state, private, and federal, from the local issues to the federal issues, to the super committee of Congress now looking at how you reform the federal budget. And so, for example, we're looking at the Lieberman-Miller attempts, which say, let's cut the wages of federal workers by another, what, $60 billion. And we're saying that that's an example of where we all have to come together. The federal workers already paid last year in furloughs and cutbacks. And now the answer to some, like Lieberman and Miller in the Senate, is cut federal workers' wages more, while we have the contractors making hundreds of thousands of dollars for their executives in their contracts with the federal government. And so we see part of our mission to advocate on behalf of federal workers as well as local workers. So it's a broad spectrum of work that we take on in California.
What's the danger there of cutting the federal workforce, not just to the federal employee and his or her family, but also to the services that those federal workers provide the American people?
It's so clear to us that, as just one example, the cutting back of Social Security offices means so much to people who go into local Social Security offices to get the services they need to understand what Social Security means to them, what the benefits are that they're going to get, and how they make sure they maximize their Social Security benefits. To close those offices of services to middle-class families is a tragedy, particularly when you see that we're spending so much money in federal contractors' executive wages. If you cut the executive wages of some of those contracts, you're going to save a lot of money, and that's where you start. But we see the approach as being an upside-down approach. Don't take away services to local people, middle-class families, working-class families, our families that need those kind of services. You start with the wages at the top. And so that's where we see the first step needing to be, and that's why we vigorously support the work of AFGE to protect those federal programs that are so important to all of us in hometown America.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Art Pulaski, the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the California Labor Federation. Art, on this notion of social safety net programs like Social Security, like Medicare, like Medicaid, why do you think that when budget discussions come up, that those seem to find their way into the conversation, given that they provide a lifeline to so many people?
I think it's because there's a narrative that's being advanced by the conservative right that we have seen attack the middle class now for 10 years or longer. And it's this consistent narrative that says, and the irony about this is that they have the gall to propose a narrative that says that it's the middle class, it's working people, it's federal employees, it's local employees who are responsible for the economic collapse. When in fact, when you look at it, in fact, there was a new, I just saw late last night, CBS covered a new CBO study that suggested that, as I recall, the income disparity of the rich is remarkable. And in all of the Western countries of the world, this is one of the worst, where over the past 30 years, while most of our wages have flattened or we've lost the income of the upper 1%, the same people that are out there, I mean, the same issue that's out there in the streets of Oakland, in the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy San Francisco, Occupy Oakland, Occupy Sacramento, across California, and we see across the nation. It's all about that 1%. And that 1% isn't happy with now having 25% of the income of all of America. Yet, what they do is they say it's really a problem with the pensions of the federal workers and the state workers and the private sector workers. And so what we see is this attack against our wages and our protections and our pensions and our health care, when if we just leveled out the income disparity, there would be more economic justice, more fairness. And why would the federal policy proposals first go after cutting the wages and the pensions of the middle class? And that's a huge fight that we see that we're engaged in.
What's the danger there of essentially squeezing the middle class? We've seen reports, and as you have mentioned, that middle class workers are making a lower percentage of the total income in America than they were years ago. What's the danger there of squeezing the middle class out of that income opportunity?
Well, California is one of the states that's most hard hit by the mortgage collapse. What we find is more and more families are losing their homes in the millions. And we also find now more and more of our working class families and members saying they can't afford to send their kid to college. The collapse of the college loan program as well. And so what we see is people not being able to afford the essentials of their lives, being able to afford health care for their kids who don't yet have a job because of the unemployment crisis, but yet now have exceeded the threshold age of age 26. I have a 27-year-old. We're spending now, our family, $800 a month just to make sure that she, who is a student, can still have her health care coverage. And so families are now at the breaking point because of these various economic challenges that they face. And we're going in the wrong direction. So the question is, how do we turn that around? And that's really the focal point for us.
Have you ever seen a time when middle-class workers have been pinched as much as they have now?
No, it's very clear that in terms of timelines, in our lifetime, in the last many generations, the middle class is more squeezed than it's ever been. And the crisis that we face is we see candidates running for president now who are saying, let's flatten the taxes. I mean, we have candidate Perry, candidate Kane, who are saying, let's flatten the taxes. Well, they have to think that we're dummies. They really do, because that means that the rich are going to pay lower taxes, and the middle class and the working class are going to pay higher taxes, and it's just not fair. That's why the union is so important, because finally we have an opportunity to have some unified voice, some organized voice to say, wait a minute, we're not dummies. We have to take that on. In California, for example, we have a real crisis in our state budget, a shortfall of, we'll find out soon, but we had an $18 billion shortfall last year in our budget. We expect a huge shortfall again. So the question is, how do we gain the revenues? There's been lots of cuts. There have been 30%, I would say, cuts in the state budget over the past few years. So we really cut it back to the core, very significant cuts in budget. So what do we do now? Well, we have to generate some new revenues. So we're doing some research now, some polling, and we see it's popular to say, let's have a millionaire's tax. Let's increase by 1% or 2% or 3% the millionaire's tax, because those are the folks that are making all the money right now. And some of them, in a private moment, would even argue that they're paying less in taxes than they were some years ago. So one thing we're going to do, for example, in California, is really advance a ballot measure to perhaps increase taxes on the very wealthy to help us in the revenue. That's what we need to do in the federal government as well, although what we see is these proposals to flatten, to lower the taxes for the wealthy. So that's a big fight I see us having in the year 2012, in the politics of 2012.
Many Americans have indicated, through polling or otherwise, that their number one concern is the lack of jobs in this country. Talk about what it's going to take to get people working again.
We need to make a commitment to jobs, and the stimulus has to come, I think, from both the feds and the state. The state, for example, we're looking at how do we provide as a state some stimulus in jobs. And the first and most important thing that both the state and the federal government need to look at is, and there's been some of that, but there's been not enough, and that is how do we rebuild the infrastructure. And particularly in California, if you drive down the freeway or some of the main roads, you'll find that they're a lot bumpier and a lot more holes in the roads than there were 10 years ago. We've had a couple of administrations within the state, governors of the state, that have neglected the infrastructure of the state. So we've got the freeway transportation infrastructure, we've got the water infrastructure in California, and we've got the educational infrastructure in California, as well as many others, that we really need to make some major investment in. And if we do, we'll create more jobs. I mean, the job multiplier effect, for example, of improving the highways. For every $1 billion you spend in building the highways, you create some, I think, 30,000 jobs. And that multiplier effect is very important to rebuilding jobs in the private sector in California and the country. And what we see is we have to support the rebuilding of jobs in the private sector as well as in the public sector. But it means revenues. It means, for us in California, having a ballot measure to raise bond money and to raise tax revenues, so that we can invest in that. And if we don't invest in infrastructure now, then the commerce will suffer later because we don't have the roads and the transportation systems to be able to move goods and services that we create. So it's important to business as well as other private sector jobs. In California, we're hoping to build high-speed rail. We've got some federal dollars to help us with that. We've done a bond measure to raise about $12 billion from California taxpayers. High-speed rail is an important way that we improve the transportation infrastructure of California and also create jobs. And that's what we want to do. We can improve the infrastructure to make the quality of life better and create jobs at the same time. You can't beat it. And that's an important aspect of jobs for now, for the short term.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government. We're here with Executive Secretary Treasurer of the California Labor Federation, Art Pulaski. Art, on the notion of infrastructure as it relates to job creation, do you see things like high-speed rail, investing in freeway, water, and education as not just simply a job for someone, but possibly a career, something they could have throughout their lives?
The building of infrastructure gives people jobs now and later. Part of the infrastructure, for example, that California is looking at is the infrastructure of the new green economy. That means, that's one example of how we must provide some ongoing retraining to the workforce so that they can have long-term permanent job skills. There are the new green economy with solar energy and wind energy in California is very important to our future, very important to us being able to have affordable energy for the future, safe and clean energy for the future, but also those jobs are important jobs for the future. So part of the educational infrastructure we see is the training of the skills for the new workforce. And so, for example, as we look at higher education for California kids for the future, we look at what we call career technical education as an important aspect of that. It may be that not all kids want to go to college for a liberal arts degree, and they need to have an option that they can get skills that will help them get a job over the short term, but also be a job skill that they have over the long term. And so part of the educational infrastructure, as we think about it, is that job creation long term for the future.
When we were talking previously about the federal government and the federal budget, one of the things that has come up is possibly looking at a cap for executive pay for contractors, taking that from its current state down to about $200,000 a year. Do you see that as a way to level the playing field a little bit when it comes to budget cuts?
It's a curious thing. Why would some in Congress now say the first way to save money is to cut the workforce who have already suffered and been cut back? When you see contractors like Booz Allen, every time I fly into Washington, you go by from Dulles Airport, you go by this big fancy buildings of Booz Allen Hamilton on the way into D.C. And those guys, they figure out a way when they have a federal contract to maximize the income for their executives. And I guess the maximum now is currently $700,000 per executive, multiple executives. Why would you allow that to happen? I'm not saying don't let them get rich, but don't let them get rich on taxpayers' dollars. So I think AFGE is right on target by saying the first thing we should do is say, okay, maybe $200,000 is enough for an executive to make off a federal contract. That doesn't limit them from making millions and millions off of their other contracts as well. But start there, because those guys, to be honest with you, is our perspective here in California, are too rich already. So don't take it out of the hides of the workforce. Just limit how rich you're going to let those guys get off of federal taxpayer dollars. And that's the right starting point. And I think AFGE is on target on that.
Shifting gears for a minute, and of course, as we look ahead to 2012, there's obviously a very important election coming up. And a key issue for you here, not just in California, but nationwide, is this issue of paycheck deception. Tell us about that.
In California, we've had two attempts to silence the voice of union members and working people. It happened in 1998. With what they called then Proposition 226. It happened in 2005 with what Arnold Schwarzenegger and his sort of attack on workers was called Proposition 75, and now there's a new one. And really what it does is it says working people or union members can no longer figure out a way to easily contribute to the political process. Their union can't use dues money for contributions to candidates. Their union can't even provide in-kind contribution like volunteers through the union for candidates. Yet business is unfettered in terms of what they can do now, especially with Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, which says that corporations can be treated as people and can do whatever they want in terms of maximizing their contributions. Before, at least, corporations were limited. The executives could give all the money they wanted into campaigns, but corporations were limited. But now corporations can do whatever they want. Yet now, at the same moment in time, they're saying unions can no longer engage in a voice in the ballot box. And so it would be catastrophic for the people of California to have, for the workforce of California, to have this limit where they can't have a voice at the ballot box, a unified voice at the ballot box anymore. We see that here in California. We also see, though, the same, even worse, crises in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Indiana, attempting again to silence the voice of workers. So we're in a battle now to make sure that even though our wages have lost over the past 30 years, we make less money in real dollars than we made, in adjusted dollars than we made 30 years ago or 20 years ago and 10 years ago. But now they're saying, let's not even allow them to have a voice at the ballot box so that we can't fight back a little bit. So one of our challenges is a defensive effort to make sure that we don't allow them. It means we're going to have to mobilize our members and community folks to oppose this new thing we expect on the ballot in 2012 in California, but also fight in terms of the national elections as well, so that we can tell the truth about these proposals that will flatten federal taxes. The intention is that the rich pay less in taxes and middle class pay more in taxes. And there's going to be a lot of work that we're going to have to do to help call out the truth on those battles.
Are you finding that workers in California are energized knowing that potentially their rights are on the line?
Well, we've seen it before, and I expect we're going to see it again, that people recognize it's just not fair to have a double standard, that corporations can do whatever they want, but the one unified voice that workers have, their union, are now hamstringed by not being able to engage in politics in any significant kind of way in the future if this thing passes in California called paycheck deception.
You've mentioned this isn't the first time that you've gone about this or had to face this challenge. This is at least time number three, correct?
And each time it's happened, in 1998, so many people came to the polls. Then Democratic Governor Gray Davis was elected governor when he wasn't expected to. Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he attacked workers' rights in 2005, lost in a big way. It was the downfall of Arnold Schwarzenegger because he was gaining popularity until he went overboard in terms of really going after workers' rights, and that's when it came back to kick him in the rear end. So people are motivated when this happens, when there's an attempt to silence their voice at work or an attempt to silence their voice at the ballot box. And it's not just union members, but it's working people in general who begin to recognize that there is a value to a union to speak up on behalf of all working families.
Do you get a sense that this wave of standing up is coming through the country? We've seen these Occupy protests all over the country, union members standing up, rallying to defend their rights that they have.
Well, we saw it in Wisconsin to begin with. We're seeing it now, and shortly there's going to be an election in Ohio over Governor Kasich's attempts to silence the voice of workers there. And now I see last night that 57% of voters in Ohio who recently elected Governor Kasich are now saying, wait a minute, he's gone too far, and oppose Governor Kasich's efforts in SB 5, what it's called in Ohio, SB 5, to silence the voice of workers there. So I see these attempts to really set us back as moments in history where people actually become motivated and become activated and go to the polls and volunteer and say, wait a minute, the other side has gone too far. And I really see that happening. It's happening in the streets now with the Occupy Wall Street, and it's happening as people prepare for the elections of 2012.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Art Pulaski, Executive Secretary-Treasurer of the California Labor Federation. Art, do you see this as a time in the labor movement's history that would be looked at as a defining moment years from now?
When people are attacked, that's when they often wake up, respond, and act. And I think that we see people recognizing the need for them to act. And again, we see it not just about what's happening on Wall Street, but what's happening in those other states where Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, been in California especially. We see it because we're here, and we see people having rallies. I mean, it was remarkable to see when Wisconsin began some 6 or 8 or 10 months ago that the next day people were in the street in rallies in Sacramento, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other places, responding in solidarity to what they saw happening as an unfairness against workers in other states. So it's a really remarkable thing to see how people are saying enough is enough and are really saying, give me an opportunity to be activated. And our job as unions is to provide some organizational opportunity for people to say, yes, this is what you can do. Knock on the door of your neighborhood, the doors of your neighborhood, to the people you know. Speak where you can to your fellow workers at work. And there's limits on some of that with particularly public employees. But we see more and more interest in understanding the need to protect the union, because the union is the only protection for you.
And how do you see public employee unions, specifically federal employee unions like AFGE, fitting into the larger labor movement as we move forward?
We all come together. And just like I saw so many workers from so many unions say, let's support the TSO workers organized for a voice at work, we see AFGE members saying, wait a minute, this can't happen in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in California. And so it all comes together. We all support each other. What we see is a remarkable movement, if you will, natural movement of people coming together to support each other.
And as you look ahead to 2012, we of course talked about the election coming up for president. How are you leading the California Labor Federation, not just from a political sense, but to overcome the challenges that you'll be facing along the way for workers' rights?
For us, the first step is looking at paycheck deception efforts to silence the voice of our workers, our members, and also how we expand state revenues for infrastructure and for education and for job creation. The union has to play a role in job creation and job preparation, that is job training. And by the way, I always say to gatherings of business groups and politicians, if you want to look at workforce preparation and job training, the best place to look at it is in the construction trades of our unions, where they have joint apprentice programs between the union and the contractor, the employer, where they both contribute to it. They jointly say, here are the skills we need to develop for these workers for the future. And our joint apprenticeship programs are really the best job preparation models you have anywhere in America, anywhere in history. So how do we replicate that for more workers? How do we provide for the right kind of educational infrastructure so that we can train our workforce, our kids for the future, but also continue to make California and America the most competitive workforces anywhere in the world? And that's what we need to really be focusing on, is how do we maintain America's great competitive nature, competitive skills. And so we look to the unions for great models of how we do that. We use it to expand those models. We engage people in politics to generate the new revenues so that we can create those jobs, so that those kids, those new workers with the new training, can have jobs and build a family for the future. And once you have that vision, if you will, people come.
For our listeners out there who want to learn more about the California Labor Federation, how can they find you?
Find us on CA Labor Fed, that's CALABORFED.org.
Art Pulaski, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the California Labor Federation, thank you so much for your time
today.
I'm
delighted. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornacola, and up next, we'll discuss key issues facing the Social Security Administration with AFGE SSA Council 220 Health and Safety Representative Howard Eggerman.
Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to buy items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount with promo code AFGEMember. That's all one word. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Howard Eggerman, the Health and Safety Rep for AFGE's Social Security Administration Council 220. Howard, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And of course, we have you here today at AFGE's District 12 training in Oakland. What are you doing here this week?
I'm giving training on health and safety here in Oakland, and I'm really delighted that AFGE 12th District have come to my hometown.
Talk about the importance of educating the AFG members on health and safety issues in the workplace.
Well, to me, it's really important that everybody know about their rights in terms of health and safety, because I feel really lucky. I started working for Social Security and joined AFG in 1973 when I left the military service. And I've been able to work my military and government service combined for 42 years. My concern is that younger people will be able to have the same opportunities and be able to deal with the type of workplace hazards and get through it so that they can have a good life. And that's one reason why I'm here, because I think it's really important to train the next generation of union leaders.
You mentioned serving in the military. What was your experience before coming to civilian service?
Well, I was just a yeoman in the Navy. All I was a clerk. But I served at the time in which you really had no choice. My choices were go to jail, go to Canada, or go into the military. And because I was a student, my body was intact, and I was able to do the two things the military considered important, which was to inhale and exhale. So I ended up being 1A.
Do you find that your service in the military prepped you well for your service as a civilian federal employee?
I think it really did, because one of the real importance in the military is you learn about diversity. And, for instance, in my company when I was in the Navy in San Diego in boot camp, we had people, high school graduates, who couldn't read or write, and we would help them get through boot camp. We had people of all different nationalities and backgrounds. And when I stood the midwatch in the evening, I could hear people snoring and breathing in and out. You didn't know who a person was, what their educational background. They were just people like yourselves. And as a Social Security employee, I deal with people of all different walks of life. And the thing to realize for everyone, whether they're part of the bargaining unit or the people we serve, is everyone hopefully is able to inhale and exhale on his or her own. We're all people.
Let's talk about your service now in the Social Security Administration. What are some of the things that you're tackling these days?
Well, we're tackling a lot of different issues. One of the major concerns that I have is that they have mechanized our job in terms of putting it on the computer. And we have a lot of people who have ergonomic and other types of injuries. I myself have had two surgeries for carpal tunnel and decurvains on my left hand, one on my right hand. And I had a ligament replacement just last year. And I'm quite concerned about this issue, and I've testified at OSHA twice on the need for an ergo standard. We also, in Social Security, interview people with a wide variety of different diseases and problems. So I testified about the need for a tuberculosis standard because we had people with active TB, and we were able to get a TB interviewing standard. Also testified about the need for indoor air quality standard because we closed the Social Security building in Richmond for a time in 1991 when there was an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, and we had our former president, great man who I admire so much, John N. Sturdivant, came to inspect the building and also speak to us at that time. So I've been active in a number of different fronts with various types of hazards, and I'm an injured worker myself, and I really want to try to prevent people from being injured on the job.
Before we got started, you and I talked a little bit about the move at Social Security to a more automated system, a lot of the iClaims initiatives and things like that. And you brought up a point that may not work for everyone, even from a physical standpoint.
Yes. So the issue of the iClaims and everything for Social Security is to realize that we are a very, very diverse community. In other words, I'm part of that. I just became eligible for Medicare in August, and this is around the same time that both Presidents Bush and Clinton, who are the same age group I am, became eligible. And not everybody knows how to use a computer at our age. Secondly, I work in an inner city, and not everybody has computer access. And people are told, for instance, here in Oakland, well, you can go to the library and file a claim. But the problem is that because of budgetary cutbacks, our libraries are closed several times a week. And you also have to have a library card. To get a library card, you have to have ID. A lot of people don't have ID. So the iClaim initiative makes no sense whatsoever in terms of who it serves. It may be better maybe 20 or 30 years when more people are computer literate. But for instance, when I was in the Navy and as well as started Social Security, there were no such thing as personal computers. I typed on a typewriter, and when I started taking claims, we took claims on paper and used typewriters, and we used the Western Union Telegraph. So these are just recent initiatives, and I think, recent death of Steve Jobs, you know, there was information about how he started Apple with Wozniak in a garage. This is not something that is that new, and for the agency to think that everybody can use a computer is just disingenuous and makes no sense whatsoever.
Given that reality, combined with some initiatives by the agency to close offices early, what's the danger there in serving the public?
I think the danger of closing offices is to realize that people want human contact. In other words, I filed for Medicare in April, and my colleagues also filed for Medicare. I didn't want to do this on the computer because when you also file online, there can be problems. You don't know if things are going to go through. You're concerned about privacy. And I wanted to deal with a person, so I called the 800 number and spoke to somebody in Birmingham. My colleagues in my office are doing the same thing. There's nothing like human contact. You can't speak to a computer. I think we all get frustrated with this voicemail and all these other menus. In other words, when you file for retirement for Medicare, it's a very personal situation. When we had recent demonstrations, I mentioned that certain people, Donald Trump, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, just turned 65. And I said, look, if there's cutbacks, and they were lucky enough to live in East Oakland instead of New York or Texas, if they tried to come to our office, we may be closed. You know, human contact is something very important at a time of retirement, a time when you lose a loved one. That's what people like myself can, or you become disabled, can provide is human contact. We're people talking to people.
throughout your time in the military and obviously serving the public through the Social Security Administration, can you remember a time that it has been so volatile towards federal workers and public service?
This is perhaps the worst time frame. In 1995, we were furloughed. This year, we've had three different possible shutdowns. And one thing that I'm concerned about is the impact of this on young people who have to worry about paying the rent and everything else. And right now, we're having the super committee, which is yet to issue a report. I'm concerned about people maybe having to go to from a high three to a high five, greater contributions to the salary. I'm concerned about these young people who may not want to stick out what's happened because, you know, we've had good presidents, bad presidents, whatever. We kept on going. This has been like the worst of all. When we had like two furloughs with Newt, and before, the furloughs may have been just half a day or something like this. This year has been totally atrocious. And one thing I did when I was in Baltimore last week is I gave management a proposal for stress management training, dealing with these particular stressors that people have. It's not just the work we face from the public or complaints or problems with the public or management. We have the issues dealing with Congress. And what Congress has to realize is the same thing that Christine O'Donnell, when she ran for the Senate from Delaware, said, "I'm not a witch, I'm one of you." Well, we're just like Congress. And because we're people, too, we have bills to pay, mortgages to pay, and everything like that. I think government service is something honorable. Put my colleagues through what they've gone through. And what I'm concerned about is what they may have to go through in the future, particularly depending on what happens in the election in November 2012. It just horrifies me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Howard Eggerman, AFGE Health and Safety Rep for the Social Security Administration's Council 220. Howard, on this notion of looking out for the people who are coming after you, the younger workers, do you think that this attack on the federal workforce really could be damaging to retaining and recruiting the best and brightest?
I really believe so. One of the things that's concerned me, and I think one of the real positive things that President Obama did, and that I'm really happy about, it's made an emphasis on hiring veterans, because I would do orientation sessions. I'd say, how many veterans are there? And a lot of times, a problem we've had in my agency is people who are hired are sons of daughters of management officials. You know, as an example, when my former manager first came to my office about 1980, we had a baby shower for him. And now that baby is a supervisor in Roseville, California. You know, we're concerned about veterans being hired. And I'm a part of a veterans organization. I've also worked and made proposals at AFGE conventions that they have groups to help out the younger veterans, because I had a heck of a time getting a job, and I did nothing but type. And people felt in 1973 that I caused the whole Vietnam War, and all I did was be a typist for the Navy, a yeoman. And what scares me is that I just want these younger people who are true volunteers, who are the true heroes of today, who didn't face jail or going to Canada as I did. I just want them to have the same opportunity to be able to have a career and be able to retire from government service. And it really causes me a lot of problems and kind of almost makes me sick that they're facing so many obstacles in the way of just being able to do the same thing I have had. So, I mean, to me, I think one responsibility all of us have as veterans, help out other vets. And I told my wife's brother-in-law's stepson, I said, you know, once you're a veteran, you're always a veteran. So even though I'm 65 years and may have served from 69 to 73, I'm still a proud veteran, and I want to see that the veterans of the Iraq wars and Afghanistan war have the same opportunity to provide federal service and get federal service that I did.
Howard, another real concern is the staffing and funding levels at SSA. Claims continue to rise. The backlog is extensive on the table. Proposals to cut the workforce. What's the danger there? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts about the danger there is that people need to realize the reason why Social Securities have all these problems deals directly with the economy. If someone cannot get a job and they have any kind of medical issue, they're going to be in our office to file for disability. If they're my age, one of the boomers, and they have no job, it's better to take your reduced retirement now than it is later. And the concern that we have with this is cutting back. We're facing more and more people filing for benefits. And what's happened this year is just really amazing. When I go to East Oakland where I work, January 2nd, we came back to work 2011, we were open to the public from 9 to 4:30. From the first budget cutback, they put all offices in California closing at 4 o'clock. After we had the near shutdown with the debt ceiling, we close now at 3:30. They keep on pushing time back so that we don't have paid overtime. What I'm concerned about is my brothers and sisters who are my age. You know, I don't know why they can't. They can go to a bank at a different time, but they cannot come into Social Security. And so we're having more and more workloads. People are actually almost being discouraged. We're supposed to tell people, file online. And I say, how are you going to file online if there's no online to file? Or call on the phone. You know, and it's a problem because we can't answer the phone because we're so busy taking claims. So it's a real, real hazard. And one thing that I'm saying as a health and safety rep is I do my union work in the morning. I take claims in the afternoon. I face the public every single day. And it really upsets me that we're having all these cutbacks at a time when the population is getting older. Now's not the time to cut back. I think people have to realize that we're not making factories making widgets or something. We're taking claims. And I always tell people just to realize that Barry Manilow writes the songs. We take the claims, and we need people to take claims.
Talk about the importance of programs like Social Security, like Medicare, like Medicaid, keeping them strong and financially viable in a time like we're in today where there's a lot of talk of cuts.
Well, the importance of keeping them, Social Security, Medicare, SSI, and Medicaid active is the thing to realize that we're dealing with a human program with real human beings. And we live in an imperfect world. People can get injured. Like I was injured on the job. People can become disabled at any time. They need something to deal with. People can lose a spouse. I mean, we have had mass casualty claims, such as after 9/11, we had all these claims in New York City. We need an agency to deal with the needs. Same time, people who are baby boomers like myself are becoming eligible for Medicare, and we want to keep on working. Like I said, I'm 65 now, about 2 or 3 months. I intend to keep on working. I'm sure Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Donald Trump intend to keep on working, as well as the other boomers that are in the whole situation. Every single day, 10,000 Americans are turning 65 years old. This is not the time to cut back. The other thing to realize is we're just dealing with people. I don't know how anybody in the right mind can let somebody get sick, whether it's from Medicaid or Medicare, and not get treated. You know, I've worked for so long, we've had different proposals, including under Jimmy Carter, to have national health insurance. You know, we just need to take care of each other. And one of the things that I feel good about being a Social Security employee is that I'm able to help out my community. And I've worked same area for 38 years. So I've been able to help out people in the Social Security Administration in East Oakland for 38 years in one community, just be a part of that community.
Do you find that your colleagues in the Social Security Administration and other colleagues throughout the federal government, despite these attacks on federal employees, maintain their professionalism and their passion for public service?
I believe this is the case. People do have their passion for public service. As an example, I'm a health and safety representative. When we've had issues in which people have had to evacuate, you know, we had one earthquake, and the people wanted to keep on taking numbers and keep on taking claims. And what we try to do, and what I try to do, is do the best I can to get the work out. I was in Baltimore last week at health and safety meetings the entire week. And on Monday, what I tried to do on my agency time was check on the status of all my claims. You know, I think it's really important that, and we all think it's important that to serve the public. And I don't want anybody whose claim I've taken to be ill-served because I'm not able to take care of or follow up on their activity for their disability claim. So I feel strongly that all of us really care about serving the public. And the thing that's important about a program like Social Security is I live in the same neighborhood as the people I serve. People have asked me at the bus stop, what's happening, Howard, on my claim? You know, I've seen them. Sometimes I say, look, I don't have the computer right now. But I see people. People will say to me at a restaurant, you work at Social Security, don't you? Or even at the mall where I work, when I see them at McDonald's. So the important thing to realize that what we do is we put a human face on government. The government's not just something in Washington, D.C. It's in a community like an inner city area like East Oakland or a urban area like San Francisco or Middle West. It's all over the country. That's where we are.
Lastly, Howard, what's next for you?
I'm going to go back to work next. In other words, I want to work as long as I can. This is just 42 years. It's possible I may make this a career. But my intention is whenever I do what I call the R word, I'm saying I'm tired now. I haven't put the R-E in front of it. I'm going to continue to help out my local. And I'm a part of my Central Labor Council in Alameda County. I'm a volunteer. I'm going to continue to do that. And I hope as well, whenever I finish work, just to get involved in activities for my community. A thing that I think it's important to realize is age is just a number. You know, I think Satchel Paige said it's a matter of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. I'm just happy that I've been able to do that. And I just want the young people to have the same opportunity that I have had. And I'm just hoping that everyone will work to ensure that Social Security programs continue, as well as to ensure that our great union, AFGE, you know, continues to grow and proper. Because the thing I think it's most important about my union, I won't be here for 42 years because, you know, we had a lot of management people who have had problems. And one thing I've been able to do over the last 42 years is basically to outlast them. But we've been able to use our union as both an officer as well as a representative and as an employee to serve as a check on management. You know, so I think if without a strong union like AFG, I wouldn't have been able to work 42 years. So, you know, one thing I want to just mention is Woody Allen once said, you know, 80% of success is showing up. Well, thanks to my union, AFG, I've been able to show up for the last 38 years, and I don't think I'll be able to make it another 38 years. I'm going to just take it 1 year at a time.
Howard Eggerman, Health and Safety Representative for AFGE's Social Security Administration, Council 220. Howard, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests this week, the California Labor Federation's Executive Secretary Treasurer, Art Pulaski, and AFGE Social Security Administration, Council 220, Health and Safety Representative, Howard Eggerman. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to buy items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount with promo code AFGEMember. That's all one word. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage.